This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Today is another opportunity to see what we have achieved, what we did together, and what we need to do together to achieve more.
That's Rwanda's Chief of the Defense Staff, General Jean Bosco Kazura, on discussions with Mozambique's officials on joint operations to fight terrorism in the Cabo Delgado province. Details coming up. Also, U.S. President Biden commends Ethiopia's Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed for the release of high-profile political prisoners. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. West African sanctions imposed on Mali this week after the country's military government postponed elections block all but essential commercial and financial transactions. While the punitive move aims to pressure the military to hold elections as promised in February, experts say ordinary Malians are also set to suffer. Annie Risenberg reports from Bamako.
Regional bloc ECOWAS, the Economic Community of West African States, imposed sanctions on Mali after a special summit on January 9th held in Accra. ECOWAS has already sanctioned members of Mali's military government and threatened further sanctions if they did not abide by a formally agreed-upon election date of February 2022. In December, Malian leaders proposed holding the next presidential elections in 2026. Malian President Assimi Goïta said that he remains open to further dialogue with ECOWAS to find a solution, despite illegitimate, illegal, and inhumane decisions by the regional bloc, and urged them to reconsider sanctions. He says, "We call on ECOWAS once again for a thorough analysis of the situation in our country, placing the best interests of the Malian population above all other considerations." Salimata Koulibaly, like more than 70% of Malians, works in the informal sector. After finishing school, she was unemployed and opened a shop with her family selling used appliances, children's toys, and clothes brought by shipping container from France via Senegal. This merchandise will not be able to pass into Mali, along with other non-essential goods, while the sanctions are in place. Salimata and her family rely on the store's income for basic living expenses.
En tout cas,
right now, she says, everything we do depends on the store. If we can't get the containers here, it's going to get us into trouble. Frankly, it will really get us into trouble. But we pray to God that ECOWAS and Mali can find an agreement so that all this is over. Kobi Annan, a risk consultant based in Accra with Songhai Advisory, a firm that does political and economic risk analyses in sub-Saharan Africa, says that Senegal is Mali's biggest import partner. He says that the widespread support of the military government in Mali will play a role in how Malian citizens view the sanctions.
People will probably be willing to take a bit of suffering for a kind of patriotic stand to show that Mali will not just back down in the face of opposition from ECOWAS. So I think they will get to a point where it will start to get difficult. You know, Mali is an import-heavy economy. They do well relatively in terms of food subsistence, but other things have to be imported. And as a landlocked country, that's especially difficult if your land borders are closed.
Guinea's military junta released a televised statement Monday affirming the country's support for Mali and stating that borders between Mali and neighboring Guinea will remain open. Guinea's former president Alpha Condé was ousted in a coup d'etat in September 2021, and the country has been under military rule since. ECOWAS has mounted pressure on Guinea to return to constitutional rule. An open border with Guinea, just 130 kilometers southwest of Bamako, gives Mali access to the port of Conakry. Annie Risenberg for VOA News, Bamako, Mali.
An Ethiopian drone strike in the country's Tigray region has reportedly killed 17 civilians. The Associated Press, quoting local authorities, says the attack occurred yesterday, the day U.S. President Joe Biden spoke by phone with Ethiopia's Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed and expressed concern about such attacks. A spokesman for Ethiopia's government and military did not respond to questions about the drone strike. Biden expressed concern to Abiy about the airstrikes, detentions, and civilian killings. He also commended the Ethiopian leader for the release of several high-profile political prisoners. A White House statement also added that the two leaders discussed ways to accelerate dialogue towards a negotiated ceasefire, improve humanitarian access across Ethiopia, and address human rights concerns. Abiy on Twitter described the conversation with Biden as candid and said he and the U.S. president agreed on the value of strengthening U.S.-Ethiopian cooperation through constructive engagement. Federal prosecutors in New York say the FBI arrested an Egyptian-American who allegedly spied on the Egyptian president's opponents in the U.S. While President Joe Biden pledged to put the defense of democracy and protection of human rights at the center of U.S. foreign policy, some experts say the United States has for decades viewed peace between Egypt and Israel as crucial to regional security. The Egyptian role in preventing escalation between Israel and Hamas may have altered the Biden administration's pledge not to give blank checks to President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi. VOA senior analyst Mohammed Al-Shanawi discussed the U.S. balancing democracy promotion and U.S. security interests with Thomas Carruthers, Vice President for Studies at the Carnegie Endowment of International Peace.
You're right. The United States has relied on Egypt for many years as a linchpin of its security policies in the Middle East. But of course, again, it's important to see that the region has changed. Egypt is no longer the only country that's trying to work productively with Israel in some ways. There are other Arab countries that are doing so now. And so the idea that Egypt is the island of a security relationship for Israel in the region just doesn't really hold anymore. But you're certainly right. This spring, when the conflict with Hamas erupted or flared up again, the fact that Sisi was ready to come forward and being helpful did provoke some gratitude, we have to say, in the Biden administration, some sense of, hey, you know, let's remember how useful he can be at certain times. But it's also important to remember that Sisi wasn't just doing that for the United States. He was doing it because it was good for Egypt, too. It's not good for Egypt when Hamas and Israel are at each other's throats. So again, it's an example of where we shouldn't overestimate how much Sisi was doing that as though he was handing a present, a security present to the United States, when he was doing something that was in his own interest, which he might well have done even if the U.S. were not in play there.
But we have to remember President Biden decided in September not to waive conditionality and withhold $130 million out of the $300 million in conditioned aid. The administration reportedly communicated new conditions for the aid to be released, demanding that Egypt end series of persecutions against civil society organizations and drop charges against or release 16 individuals. Did that work?
I would say it's probably not working yet, because I think Sisi has learned that if he waits this out, he feels like he'll eventually get what he wants. But we have noted in the last 4 or 5 months, he's gone through some of the motions of saying, no, no, I'm doing better on human rights. Look, I have a new human rights policy. I'm taking this or that initiative. This person got off with a light punishment. But we don't see a real fundamental change in Sisi's behavior. But it was a pretty weak pat on the wrist, if you will, the $130 million out of the overall relationship. It was not a very strong signal to Sisi. And I think the signal he took away was, it's a pat on the wrist, but I can keep on being myself and I'll basically get what I want. So until the United States steps up its stance on human rights in Egypt, I don't expect we'll see much change in the really terrible situation that exists in Egypt.
So to what extent can assistance be used as a leverage by the U.S. to push for transition to real democracy in Egypt and respect of human rights?
Well, I don't think the U.S. military assistance to Egypt is enough of a lever in itself to change the whole political direction of Egypt. But I do think if properly sort of employed as a lever, it can at least try to trim or limit the excesses of Sisi's campaign against human rights in Egypt. So I don't think we should put it in terms of can the United States sort of force a change towards democracy in Egypt so much as can the United States at least push the government to limit just some of the outer boundaries of the terrible things that it's doing.
The Biden administration has publicly and privately raised democracy and rights issues with various security partners who are undemocratic or democratically backsliding. How do you explain its cautious approach towards some of them, like Egypt and Saudi Arabia?
Well, there's some places where I think the cautious approach, Mohammed, comes from two things. One, an assessment that the United States really wants to maintain the security or economic relationship. And two, not very much optimism about the possibility of change. I think, unfortunately, U.S. policymakers have gotten in the mindset that Saudi Arabia and Egypt are where they are in terms of being autocracies, and it's just hard to foresee change.
But many parts of the U.S. defense, intelligence, and diplomatic establishments strongly believe in the value of close partnerships with countries like Egypt, Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates, while they are representing a counter-democracy axis in the Middle East and in North Africa. What's your take on that?
I think, unfortunately, what you say is true, and I think it's something that could and should be changed. I think the United States can have a different approach to Egypt. I think a tougher love approach, or even not very much love at all, would be better. I don't think the United States is as dependent on Egypt in security terms as it sometimes thinks it is. And I think the United States is behind the times on Egypt. I think we've failed to take on board the fact that Egypt is both a worse case politically than we sometimes seem to say. It has really gone into the dark ages. And secondly, that's not going to last. The Egyptian population is reaching a breaking point. So I think the United States government could and should lean forward more on Egypt and say this is crucial to potential change in the Arab world that would be good for the Arab world, good for its citizens, and good for the United States as well.
That was Thomas Carruthers, Vice President for Studies at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, speaking with VOA's Mohammed Al-Shanawi. Military and police senior officers from Mozambique have met with their Rwandan counterparts to assess the success of joint operations to fight terrorism in Cabo Delgado province. It's been 6 months since Rwanda sent troops to help Maputo regain many parts of the country that were captured by terrorists. Eugene Uimana has the details from Rwanda's capital, Kigali.
According to statements by both Mozambican and Rwandan forces, peace comes after 6 months of fighting in Mozambique's Cabo Delgado province. Insurgents linked to the Islamic State of Iraq were removed 4 years after they attacked and captured the area. The chief of general staff for Mozambique Armed Defense Forces, Admiral Joaquim Rivas Magrassi, said the talks in Rwanda considered further security arrangements towards sustaining peace in their country. He said Mozambican authorities want to highlight the dedication of the Rwanda Defense Forces for their support in fighting terrorism, with the region returning to normal and people recovering from the fighting. He says military officials from Kigali and Maputo are working to enhance capacity building through training and by equipping the military to fight insurgents wherever they may be. Rwanda's Chief of Defense Staff, General Jean Bosco Kazula, said sitting in the same room from where military officers from both countries plan to remove the rebels is proof that they can do more by working together.
Today is another opportunity to see what we have achieved, what we did together, and what we need to do together to achieve more.
Both Rwanda and Mozambique say the insurgents have been weakened. The goal now is to stabilize the situation, introduce security reforms, and repatriate affected civilians from internally displaced camps. Colonel Ronald Gwivanga is the spokesman of the Rwanda Defense Force.
The other issue that we discussed also is ways in which to improve, to start the training of Mozambican defense forces so that we fulfill the last element that we discussed of security sector reform in order to give, to provide the requisite capacity to the forces in Mozambique to be able to stand on their own when we make the decision to withdraw in the future.
A major victory for Rwandan and Mozambican forces was the capture last August of the port city of Masimbo on the Praia, a major stronghold of the insurgency. The city holds the district headquarters and airport. According to Rwanda's defense force, Mozambican forces advanced from the south, while their Rwandan allies moved in from the north and west. The African Union has applauded the success of the cooperative effort. Eugene Uwimana for VOA News, Kigali, Rwanda.
Kenya is experiencing a nationwide power outage. A Reuters report says the blackout occurred after towers supporting a high-voltage power line connecting the capital of Kiambere hydroelectric dam collapsed. State-controlled utility Kenya Power confirmed the outage was nationwide and said its engineers are working to restore the electricity supply. In May 2020, Kenya experienced a similar nationwide outage after a high-voltage power line that transmitted power to Nairobi broke. A South African civil society group has filed a criminal complaint with the U.S. Justice Department against one of the world's leading management consulting firms. This follows the release last week of a report by a commission of inquiry into government corruption in South Africa when Jacob Zuma was president from 2009 until 2018. The State Capture Report implicated Boston-based Bain and Company in graft at the South African Revenue Service. Darren Taylor has more.
Bain is a multinational contracted by governments and big corporations all over the world to draw up efficient management strategies. The Commission of Inquiry under Judge Raymond Zondo says the Zuma administration paid Bain in 2014 to restructure South Africa's tax collection agency, SARS. Guided by Bain, says Zondo's report, the man Zuma appointed to lead SARS, Tom Moyane, identified highly experienced tax officials who then lost their jobs. Their replacements and Moyane then allegedly looted billions of dollars from SARS. Bain denies it willfully or knowingly participated in graft in South Africa. But the Public Interest SA group has used the US Foreign Corrupt Practices Act to lay a criminal grievance against Bain with America's Justice Department.
It's easier to register a complaint, seemingly, with the US Department of Justice than it would be with the local police.
Teboho Haas, the organization's chair, says it approached U.S. authorities last Thursday. Less than a day later, says Haas, the U.S. Justice Department accepted its documentation and evidence against Bain and undertook to look into the case.
That is the kind of seriousness with which they attach to matters that are related to corporate malfeasance, which I think is lacking in our instance. You'd recall with some of the cases locally, there's still a need to investigate or to pursue criminal charges against those who have been fingered for corruption or other wrongdoings. The fact that the US is thousands of miles away, thousands of kilometers away from these shores, certainly just makes it intriguing, but not at all difficult. In fact, I was astounded that actually the response was that swift, efficient, and hopefully it will be fruitful.
Haas says he approached the U.S. Justice Department because he has little faith that South Africa's National Prosecuting Authority, the NPA, will chase charges against Bain. After all, he says, another inquiry linked Bain to corruption 4 years ago.
We understand the capacity issues that the NPA might be faced with, but certainly we believe that they could have at least done something to be able to share with the public, say this is what they've done since 2018 when that report was issued. But nothing has happened.
Haas says U.S. justice officials clearly take corruption very seriously, even if it allegedly involves one of America's flagship consultancy firms. He's still demanding, however, that local prosecutors build a case against Bain.
The NPA ought to with his own right, be able to investigate and ensure that Bain is called to account, and if it is found to have transgressed the rules, to make sure that it faces the music just as any other corporate South Africa or even individuals would face under the rule of law.
Haas is also demanding better treatment of Athol Williams, the former Bain executive who blew the whistle on its allegedly corrupt relationship with the Zuma administration. Haas believes Williams' testimony is an excellent basis for a thorough probe into Bain's activities in South Africa, which Zondo says netted it about 2 billion rands. Williams is in hiding due to death threats.
It cannot be that we have the likes of Mr. Williams being forced to seek refuge elsewhere because of the good things that he's done by making a stand against corruption in this country. It shouldn't be. We should be the one making life difficult for those who are accused or implicated in wrongdoing.
Instead, says Haas, some of those implicated in the report continue to roam South Africa in jets and luxury SUVs, protected by phalanxes of bodyguards. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
Pre-tournament favourites Morocco and Senegal broke scoreless ties with late goals to win their first matches at the Africa Cup of Nations tournament in Cameroon yesterday. Sadio Mane netted a penalty 7 minutes into extra time as Senegal, with just 18 players available because of COVID-19 and injury, downed Zimbabwe 1-0 in Group B. Morocco edged Ghana by the same score in the opening Group C match. Morocco won all six of its World Cup qualifiers between September and November, while Senegal had 5 wins out of 6 in their group. Isiaga Sela scored a first-half goal to steer Guinea to a 1-0 victory over depleted Malawi in the second Group B clash. Malawi had 13 players out due to a COVID-19 outbreak in their camp. Morocco's Sofiane Boufal seized on a loose ball to score 7 minutes from time to ensure a share of top place in Group C with Gabon. In the second Group C match, the tiny Comoros Islands fell 1-0 to Gabon as Aaron Boupediza scored from a tight angle. On Tuesday, Egypt and Nigeria highlight the action with defending champions Algeria taking on Sierra Leone and Guinea-Bissau facing Sudan. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbili Abaro, thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's newsmaker interview program. Join us each Saturday and Sunday when we talk with authors, analysts, and policymakers who provide fresh insight on topics ranging from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. You can listen to Press Conference USA on the radio or online at voanews.com/PCUSA. While you're visiting our website, be sure to subscribe to our podcast. We'd also love to hear from you. Just send an email to pcusa@voanews.com or connect with us on Facebook at facebook.com/CarolCastielVOA or on Twitter at CarolCastielVOA. That's Press Conference USA every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
sports fans. Brighten your day by tuning in to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 1630 and 1830 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on the Voice of America.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bobo music to hip life, bonga flavor to soukous, afrobeat to ndombolo and makossa to kwaito. The African beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 0905 and 2005 UTC, right